He is Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Hey there, Marjorie.
Hello, Jim.
Joining us in Studio 3, as he does once a month, is Governor Deval Patrick. The governor is taking our questions and yours. You can communicate them, as many are already doing, at 877-301-8970 or email them to bprandwgbh.org. There aren't many more of these left, Governor.
Hey there, Jim.
Hey there, Mark. How are you?
Yeah, I think the governor can be very, very upset when they're all over. I don't know.
Do you want to comment on that?
I have enjoyed being with you.
Thank you. Well, let's start with the big news story of the week, the whole immigration issue of the kids, the unaccompanied children. Some of them you've offered to bring to Massachusetts. Big brouhaha, but there's some summit among people that don't want them here, some of the Republicans that don't want them here, some of the mayors. You've said this week you've been sort of misunderstood. So what are people misunderstanding about your plan?
Did I say that?
I think you said that people were misrepresenting what you said about your plan to bring some of these kids. They haven't come yet, and
right.
They may not come at all.
That's right.
But you've offered, if they do come, if the president wants them to come here, you've offered to take them.
Yeah. Well, we were asked, as I think all or many governors were asked by the Federal Department of Health and Human Services, if we could provide temporary shelter for some number of kids to help relieve the surge down in the southern border, which has created a humanitarian crisis. And they were very clear about the specs, if you will. They asked for up to 1,000 square feet to, excuse me, up to 90,000 square feet of space to temporarily house up to 1,000 kids for up to 4 months. And and the experience in other states has been that the average stay of an individual child is about 30 or 35 days for them to process through the immigration laws. Other states are doing it. Arizona and Texas have had shelters for a long time, but California has added temporary shelter. I think Oklahoma has as well. Once they asked us to scope out places we thought would be suitable, and they gave us suggestions, everything from military bases to shopping malls or, you know, empty camps and things like that, that it had to be secure and it would be at the sole and exclusive cost of the federal government, both in terms of the sort of rent of it, but also the staffing of it. So we proposed these two destinations, one at Joint Base Cape Cod, or Camp Edwards as it's known down in Bourne, and the other Westover Air Base out in the west. And whether either one of them is chosen is up to, and when, is totally up to the federal government.
Are you, there's been a significant amount of opposition. You referred to some of the comments at a meeting in Bourne where one of your assistant secretaries went as, quote, coarse and unhelpful. What do you think the basis for the opposition here? Is it concern that the feds aren't going to fund the whole thing, even though you say they will? Is it about the color of these kids' skin? Is it worry about draining local resources? What do you think is the motivation?
Well, I think there are reasonable concerns, and there are lots of unanswered questions or presumed issues, I should say, out into the future, which is frankly why we had the press, the media avail that we did, because normally I wouldn't go out and say this is what we're thinking about. We'd wait until we had an actual decision with some real data, but there was so much chatter out there. We thought we ought to tell people what was happening and what we knew. But some of the comments are not helpful. When people say, you know, I moved to the Cape so that I wouldn't have to live next to, quote, these people, unquote, that is not helpful. Nor, by the way, does it even speak to what we're talking about. Nobody has proposed bringing these undocumented children into Massachusetts neighborhoods. We've talked about a temporary facility which is secure and excluded from others because they are being processed under the immigration laws. And there ought to be, it seems to me, a humane and appropriate setting for them to wait while that's being done.
Are you comfortable saying that despite the fact that the $3.7 billion budget request the president has made, the Republicans in the House have basically shown very little interest in. Are you still comfortable saying that 100% of the costs of this are going to be borne by the federal government?
It's not going to happen unless 100% of the cost is borne by the federal government. That is their pledge, and it's our condition. It's not something we dreamt up. This isn't about creating some new thing different from what the federal government normally does to process unaccompanied children. It's about relieving the crowding in the facilities they have on a temporary basis, so offering some shelter for, if you will, the overflow.
You know, one last thing on this, Governor Patrick, because there's a lot of skepticism about the federal government saying, you know, we send these people to Massachusetts, young people, families, whatever, and then the feds don't reimburse us. So how do we know that, you know, it's like the state mandates. When the state mandates X, Y, and Z for individual towns, then the state doesn't pay up like it's supposed to. There's skepticism about that. You hear that, people that are opposing this. So how do we know that they're going to pay? Will it be up front, or do we have to ask to get reimbursed?
We're not going to run it. I mean, I don't understand. I think I understand the question, but this is why I think, to some extent, maybe people aren't hearing what we're saying. We aren't saying we will run something and you pay us for it.
Okay.
We are saying here's some space. If you want to run your thing there, you can run your thing there. It's totally on the federal government because it's a matter of federal law.
Our phone number is 877-301-8970. Your phones are full. The governor started taking calls in a minute. And then as soon as one call disappears, you should make another one. Marjorie?
We're going to go to the phones?
No, you said you wanted to bring something else up about kids, you told me this morning. I don't know what it is.
I think I sort of did. The skepticism about this.
Yeah. No. You were talking about the ranking thing. You told me about this.
Before we go to the...
Yes.
Would you like to introduce that subject? But I was going to say before we go
before
to
you
the,
go, what?
To the child
go ahead.
Well-being.
Sure.
You know, look, I think there are lots of reasons why, good and sound reasons why people are skeptical about whether the federal government is going to sort of take up their end of this bargain if they do. And I think they have a whole lot to do with folks' passions around the immigration debate. And I totally get that. What I'm trying to say is this is we don't have to solve the immigration debate to do right by 17 to 3-year-olds who are living in overcrowded, inappropriate settings on a temporary basis.
Right.
That's all.
But part of the reason, again, for the skepticism, you have people like Congressman Stephen Lynch, who's a Democrat, going on this fact-finding mission and then coming back and saying, actually, what happens is a lot of these people, kids or adults, the majority of them, is his contention, do wind up staying, not necessarily in Massachusetts, but staying with their relatives here. They may have parents here, which is, you know, and that we're going to end up with the cost in the school system, and that freaks everybody out.
Well, just on that, part of the processing is, or one of the options, I guess, in the processing of these kids once they come out of shelter is reuniting them with their parents. That's not a permanent thing, by the way. That can precipitate the deportation of the whole family, frankly. But they need a place to be that is appropriate while the legal system plays itself out. And we are a government of laws and a land of laws, and that's appropriate. I am very sensitive, by the way, to the communities who are having an influx of new students, whether they come from, you know, overseas or from Indiana.
Yep.
Because the way our funding formula works, which is based on student population, is that it's paid in arrears, which is to say you get to count the kids from last year. And how we move that funding up so it's more current, I think, is a perfectly valid issue and one we should work on.
I did have something else about children. It's a happier thing. The Annie E. Casey Foundation came out with very good news for the Commonwealth. You want to tell people what it is, Governor?
Yeah, we were ranked in an independent study as the best state in the nation for child well-being. And that was based on a whole host of factors, including the quality of the schools, the fact that we have near universal health care now. 99%+ of children are insured, and 90%+ of them have access to a primary care physician, which is a great thing. There were issues around crime, teen pregnancy, which is another factor in there, which has gone down dramatically nationally. But even more so in Massachusetts. So a really good report. Another great milestone we're proud of. And I will say, to everyone's credit, at the announcement yesterday or the day before when it happened, everyone said this is good. Now, what's next? How do we keep going?
Governor, let's go to the calls. It's Governor Deval Patrick, 877-301-8970. Governor.
Let's see. Amy is calling from Somerville. Amy, you there?
Hi, Amy.
I'm here.
Hi.
Can you hear me? First of all, Governor Patrick, I want to thank you so much for, you know, just voicing your support of these children. I really appreciate what you said so far and, you know, talking about what we did in 1939 with the kids fleeing Nazi Germany. And I think my big question is, I have a son who's adopted actually from Guatemala.
Oh, is that right?
And yeah, and so I see this and I think, oh, you know, that actually, you know, it's not so far-fetched to think that this could have been his reality had he not been adopted. So my, you know, this is a cause really close to my heart. And I just want to know what we can do as citizens of Massachusetts to make sure, I mean, who can we pressure to make sure that these, you know, Camp Edwards Air Force and the place in Chicopee is opened? What can we do as, you know, citizens of Massachusetts?
First of all, Amy, thank you for the support. We've gotten hundreds of calls in the governor's office from people all over the Commonwealth offering ways to help people in faith communities, people not in faith communities, people who just understand that we're talking at the end of the day about children who were alone in a foreign land. And I really appreciate that. And we've been trying to gather those names and contact information so that when and if federal HHS chooses one of our two sites, and I emphasize the if because it's entirely about whether they exercise that that option and feel that one of those two sites works, then I hope that there is a way that concerned adults can help. I don't think there's anything to do around pressuring them to make a decision, because really what they're trying to do is build a list of options for safety valves so they can take some of the pressure off of the existing facilities closer to the border, and the rest of that, rest of those judgments will be up to them.
Amy, thank you for the call. I appreciate it. Governor?
Let's see. Roberta is calling from Ashby. Roberta, you there?
Hi, Roberta.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi.
I'd like to change the subject, and I'd like to know how the governor reconciles what appears to me to be a paradox in his support of the climate change initiative and its call for reduction of Massachusetts' energy dependent on fossil fuel-based energy sources, and his support of 190 miles of 36-inch gas pipeline infrastructure proposed to cross Massachusetts for production of electricity.
Roberta, who told you I supported the pipeline?
Well, it's your head of DPU, who was part of the six New England states putting out a request for increase in electricity generation through gas.
So just to be clear, I do not believe, first of all, I do believe and support the greenhouse gas reduction initiatives. Of course, I support them. I put them out there, and I think that they can be achieved. I don't believe that we can go to a fossil fuel-free environment in one step. I do think we have to bridge from here to there, and I think that there is no doubt but the natural gas, or little doubt, but the natural gas is cleaner than the coal-fired plants we have, two of which have shut and the third of which we're going to shut. I have not taken a position on the pipeline that is proposed. In fact, I will say I'm skeptical of the pipeline that is proposed, if we're talking about the same thing, the Kinder Morgan project. And yes, I do think that the we have a great opportunity in legislation that's pending in the legislature right now that would enable us to bring hydro into larger scale hydro into Massachusetts as well, which is a renewable source, and is not just good on the greenhouse gas side, but also good on the from the perspective of lower cost electricity. So I'm really hopeful that that bill will emerge before the legislature finishes.
Roberta, thanks. On that note, we have a ton of email, actually, on the very same subject, and I want to square what you said about your skepticism with what Jane from Pittsfield emails. Mm-hmm. Governor, you signed on to a letter asking that every electric ratepayer in Massachusetts and New England, in parentheses, be charged a tax on their electric bill to pay for a new gas pipeline to be built through Massachusetts, and then she goes on to say she's not crazy about it. Is that true?
Well, all of the governors are in favor of a I'm not sure what letter she's talking about, but all of the governors are in favor of bringing more lower-cost natural gas into New England, again, in our case, as a transition to a fossil-free future. It is, without a doubt, better than having the Mount Toms, for example, burn coal out in Holyoke so that we in the Berkshires can have our electricity when the light is switched.
Governor, I have a question for you. We have rarely gotten the kind of response on an issue that we've gotten in the last week on this whole market basket thing. We had a guy in here yesterday, 41 years with the company, started at 14, fired on Sunday. Yeah. Another guy standing across from him, 27 years with the company, started at 14, fired. Huge response. You're quoted in the Lowell Sun saying, I want economic peace in the Commonwealth, but that's a private dispute among private family members and a private company. There could potentially be loss of thousands of jobs if this thing implodes. We could lose a huge employer in Massachusetts. Isn't that the perfect situation for an appropriate one for a governor to weigh in?
Well, no, not yet. First of all, it's a family matter, and it's a pretty dysfunctional family, from what I can tell, from what I've read, and that's not going to be solved by this governor or any other governor intervening. I read recently, maybe as early as this morning, that the former CEO and his wing of the family, is that the right way to say it?
Yeah, that's right.
His side of the family are interested in buying out the the other side of the family, and maybe there's peace there. But as tempting as it is, and as frequently as I am asked, I'm not sure it's always appropriate for the governor to feel like he has to have an opinion on absolutely everything, or that an opinion in this case matters. Obviously, I'm worried about the disruption in the lives of the people who work in that company. There's no doubt about that. But beyond expressing my concern about that, there's not a lot of power that a governor has to intervene in what is a private family dispute.
But you can be kind of a emotional, sentimental guy. I mean, have you ever seen this in your lifetime, where the employees, the boss gets canned? We've all seen bosses get canned. I'm sure you've seen bosses get canned in your life, where the employees, as Jim just said, put their 40-year careers on the line to go out knowing they're probably going to get fired. There's no union there. It's a pretty dramatic story.
Right. And I can have an opinion, but when the governor has an opinion, it's news.
Yeah.
And it is presumed to be a factor. And so I'm going to have an opinion. I'm going to keep it to myself.
And okay. So, Governor, when you said in response to my question, then we'll move on, you said something like at this time or yet or something. Are you contemplating at some point, or could you contemplate getting involved in this? You're just not now?
I love that kind of question.
Well, no, but I mean, I'm only asking, I should say this, is because the level of interest and support for these workers is unlike anything I frankly have ever seen, as Marjorie said a minute ago. And so my question, can you imagine a circumstance in which you could get involved here?
Well, if you can imagine a circumstance in which the governor has some authority to get involved, we can talk about it. But otherwise, it's just an opinion. It's just a point of view. I am worried about all these folks whose livelihoods have been disrupted. And I'm worried about the disruption of a company in apparent turmoil. But there isn't a lever that I know of yet that a governor can pull in order to get this thing on track. And the on track from the point of view of the employees is having the ousted CEO return to his job. And I don't actually think that's a road that you want to have governors go down.
Let's go back to the calls. Governor Deval Patrick.
Let's see. Is it Julio? Julio from Chicopee?
Yes. Hey, how you doing, Deval?
Am I saying it right, sir?
Yeah, Julio.
Julio, okay.
All right, my question has to do with how does giving the chief of police more discretion for suitability on FID cards, how is it going to help out crime in the city? And when it's just depriving citizens of their born rights.
Julio, are you talking about the gun bill?
Yes, the gun bill.
So which version do you like, the one in the House or the one in the Senate?
I actually don't like none of them. No disrespect.
Okay. That's okay.
I don't want to disrespect what I'm saying, because it's, we shouldn't have to go through all that. Some of us, we go, we, you know, we pay the money to go get our background check. We fingerprint ourselves.
Right.
And, you know, we register our guns. We go, we do all that, and we still get harassed when the ones that are committing the crimes are people that are getting the hands of the guns illegally.
Who's harassing you?
I'll just leave my thing like that. I'm just saying. Hello?
Julio, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
I'm sorry, I lost you there at the end.
Oh, yeah, the harassment is just everything we hear from the media and chief of police. They want more discretion towards a gun. That it shouldn't be like that. We are born with these rights in this country. Once you're an American citizen, you are born with those rights. And infringed means that those rights cannot be taken away from you no matter what.
Well, I don't think either the House or the Senate, but just, Julio, let me just say for the listeners who may not know what we're talking about, there's a, and you correct me if I'm not on point. There is a proposal in the legislature right now that I think it's fair to say is a response to some of the terrible tragedies in Connecticut and elsewhere about how to tighten what are frankly already pretty tight gun control laws, how to tighten them further here in the Commonwealth. I had proposed a bill. The House has proposed a bill. The Senate has a different version they have voted on. And the one remaining issue, and I think what you're getting at, is a difference between the House and the Senate side on how much discretion a local chief of police has on long guns. I think it's long guns. Am I right? It's rifles and
shotguns.
And shotguns.
Rifles and shotguns. Yeah.
Right. How much discretion the local police chief has in the issuing of that license. And that's, again, for people who don't know the way it works right now, it's the local police chief who makes the decision about issuing the license within some parameters. And this, the House side, I think, is fair to say, at least as I see it, clarifies what those parameters are. The Senate side broadens that discretion. Is that fair? I don't know if you've been following it as closely, but that's how I see it. I actually like the House side better. They have to work out those differences before we get a final bill. I think I'm right, Julio, that that goal, which is the local chapter of the NRA, praised
the gun actors.
The House version when it was first passed, and then worked on the Senate side to change the part you were talking about in terms of
the
rifles, the rifles and the shotguns on the Senate side. So I'm not sure where they are as between the two. They've sort of supported each of them at different stages, and we'll see what we get in the final bill, and I'll go from there.
Julio, thanks for the call. Governor, one last thing on MarketBest. We just got an email from someone who doesn't want to be identified and said, when the issue, I assume this is about the maids and others at the Hyatt, was hot, you urged a boycott of the Hyatt. Why there, where you don't have any formal power to do anything, except the bully pulpit, which is rather large of governor, do you urge a boycott and here decide that you don't have a role to play?
Actually, what I did in the case of the Hyatt is urge state employees who have conferences or travel not to use Hyatts. I have some influence there.
Would you urge them not to shop at Market Basket?
You keep asking me the same question in a different way.
But what's the answer to that?
The answer is the same. It's a private issue with a private company, and I hope they get it resolved soon.
Okay, back to the calls. Governor Deval Patrick.
Let's see. Wynn is calling from Wayland.
Yes, good afternoon. Thank you, Governor.
Sure.
The solar programs that you've initiated have made Massachusetts a national leader in renewable energy, and has made solar an area of very strong economic growth. As the current programs and incentives are changing for the state, what is the next chapter for solar in Massachusetts that will keep it leading the way?
The next chapter, when I think, is probably around the so-called SRECs, which is part of the economic framework within which the solar application has been so successful. We've gone from 3 megawatts, I think it was, when we first came to office, to nearly 600 today. And we've had double-digit job growth as well, proving that you can have clean and alternative energy emphasis in policy and also get strong economic performance. The bill that really takes us to the next chapter and continues this expansion is another one of the ones waiting for action in the legislature before they finish, and I sure hope they get to it. I don't really see this as controversial. I think most people don't. It's just a question of closing the deal and getting it to me before they wrap up next week.
I win. Thanks, Nicole. Governor, before we take a brief break, John Fish, head of Suffolk Construction, who obviously is heading the effort to bring an Olympics to Boston in 2024, was with us a week or two ago. Were you on this Olympics bid thing?
It's exciting. I'm excited about it. I mean, obviously, they have to make a compelling, practical case, both to the USOC,
yeah,
and to the people of the Commonwealth. John is a very pragmatic guy and a very effective leader, and it's going to take a wide coalition in order to put something like that together. But I love the idea that the city and the Commonwealth is thinking big and looking out. I think those are good things for us.
We got to take a break. He is Governor Deval Patrick. He's with us and you till 1 o'clock. You can call him at 877-301-8970. You can email him at bpr@wgbh.org. We'll be right back.
I'm Bob C. Tomorrow on WGBH's Morning Edition, How Loud is Too Loud? Emily Rooney looks into the enforcement of noise laws for motorcycles in and around Boston. Tomorrow, only on WGBH's Morning Edition.
This year's WGBH Boston Globe Summer Arts Weekend is great music for everyone from everywhere. And it's free. This weekend in Boston's Copley Square, presented by Citizens Bank. More at bostonsummerarts.com.
Funding for our programs comes from you and Samets Blackstone Associates for more than 30 years helping businesses and nonprofits tell their stories and build relationships through integrated brand strategy, design, and digital media. You can follow them on Twitter at SAMETZ. And from Aesthetic Reconstructive and Implant Dentistry, Newton Wellesley, committed to providing a patient-centered, minimally invasive, and scientific approach to dental care and patients' overall health. More at aridnw.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browder. She is Marjorie Egan, and he, most importantly, is the governor of the Commonwealth, Deval Patrick. Hello there, Governor.
Hello.
Governor Ryan Facebooks us and says, Colorado and Washington both voted to legalize recreational marijuana. A year later than voters in Massachusetts approved medical marijuana. You know what the end of the question is. Yeah, and we're still waiting for the first dispensaries to open. What do you say to Ryan, please?
Ryan, be patient. Better to do it right than do it fast. And I think actually it was useful for the Department of Public Health to slow down the process, and because they were so keen to be very transparent about every step, they put the first cut out there, and they got attacked for not having done the second cut before they had gotten to the second cut. And I think it's been very, very important for them to slow down, take it slow, do it right. I was at the Great Barrington Farmers Market.
They're upset, Great Barrington, I understand.
They are mad.
They
say, we're going to be one of the counties without, as this guy put it, being able to get medical weed with me bought it. I know that there is a charge to try to get a facility in every county, but I think we all want to make sure that they are fully vetted and fully qualified to do what the law says that they're permitted to do.
Well, I interviewed the woman, Karen Van Uben, or my apologies, the woman who's running the medical marijuana thing. She said she expects the first dispensary to open in November. Is that still
from
on
DPH?
Track? Yeah, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Okay.
So, Governor Patrick, if the legalization, full legalization like they have in Colorado and Washington were on the ballot in 2016, as many people think it will be, how would you vote?
I probably
did
vote.
Say
against.
Oi?
I mean, I did say oi.
Okay.
I probably vote against it.
You would?
Yeah. I mean, look, I'm this is You know, you remember when...
Did you ever smoke pot when you were a scholar at Harvard?
Never.
Never?
I know.
Never?
I know.
Were you kind of a nerdy guy
I
at
was,
Harvard? Did you
I
have
was.
A few beers at Harvard?
Not really. I mean...
No?
I had my vices, but that
really?
Wasn't...
Really? What were your vices? You
okay,
smoked.
Not today.
You smoked?
Not... No.
Oh.
No. Cigarettes?
Yeah.
No.
Okay, so no drinking, no pot, no cigarettes.
No, I didn't say no drinking. You asked me about beer.
Okay. Oh, what'd you drink?
Oh, my God.
Scotch?
Really?
Yeah, I think, what are you looking at me for?
Oh,
I'm not
I know.
In charge.
Save me, Jim.
Just curious. I mean, you're almost out of office. A little glass of wine, a little scotch, a little bourbon?
Sometimes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. Okay. Sometimes. Never smoke pot. Wow, that's unbelievable.
I know. It's.
They were going to put the pot dispensary down at the bottom of my street. I was all excited. Then they moved it.
Okay, Marjorie, moving on.
Moving on.
I just want to point out that you're growing it in your own backyard is not lawful. You know that, don't you?
I'm not growing it in my own backyard. We have a question also from Facebook from Joseph about the probation trial. Given the impending outcome of the John O'Brien corruption trial and its allegations of state legislators participating in the hiring rigging, what will you as governor do to address this serious corruption problem before leaving office? Should everyone involved be required to appear before a grand jury? If people don't know, the jury's out.
Seventh day, right?
On this case. And it does, as Joseph said, allegations of rigging. And in House Speaker DeLeo's opinion, besmirching his reputation.
Well, look, I mean, there's some serious allegations in the case. I'm sorry, Marjorie, did I cut you
no,
off?
No, go ahead.
There's some serious allegations in the case. They're worrisome to me. The judge has gone out of his way to instruct the jury that patronage is not unlawful. And patronage, even as distasteful as what is described in this this case, may not be unlawful. The question is, was it tantamount to a bribe? And that's what the jury has to sort out. So I think, you know, and people have a lot of unease about the notion, and I do, about the notion that you can get a job. And by the way, the jobs in probation are really important jobs.
Very important.
That you can get a job without having the qualifications to do it. And that's exactly the kind of thing that undermines confidence in government. Now, not every time you hire someone you know, is it necessarily the case that they're unqualified to do the job. But the examples that were brought out in the lawsuit are the worst possible kinds of examples. Whether they amount to a crime is what the jury's going to tell.
But even if they're, I'm sorry, Marjorie.
You mentioned that your wife, who's an attorney, if people don't know this, remarked, and many people have remarked as well, that it's rather odd for prosecutors to accuse, as they did, Speaker DeLeo of being in the quid or the quo end of this bribe. I don't know what.
Yeah, that was weird.
Without a chance to go to court or defend himself.
Yeah, that was weird. I mean, if unusual in my experience as a lawyer and Diane's as well. It just seems like, you know, we have a system where you get to confront your accuser, and if he really was at the center of it, you know, at a minimum, you'd think he'd be called as a witness. I'm not trying to second guess the prosecution, their strategy and all that. It just seemed very unusual.
By the way, Karen Van Unen is the woman who's head of the dispensary.
Thank
the
you.
Thing, and my apologies for not remembering her last name. Just one last thing on this, though, that even if it turns out...
On the dispensaries?
No, I'm sorry, on the probation thing. Even if the jury comes back with all not guilties, the things that have... Facts that have not been... The allegations that have not been contravened are like the Senate president recommending and then pursuing through a staff person the recommendation of a guy who was fired 2 years later for heroin possession, was deemed, quote, woefully underqualified by a judge on the panel that ended up doing the hiring.
Right. That can't stand.
21-year-old girl. So not guilty across the board. What does one do? You talked about cleaning up the culture on Beacon. What do you do to as you're in your final months to deal with those kinds of situations?
On Facebook, how do you clean up the corruption?
Who was it that asked the question? What was it?
His name is Joseph.
So what Joseph should know is that when these allegations were first made, we moved legislation to reform the hiring in probation, and that legislation was enacted. So the practices that are on trial today are not the practices today. That reality has changed over there. And the leadership of probation has changed, as you know.
Okay, Governor, back to the calls, if you would, please.
Let's see. Colin is calling from Winchester. Colin, you there?
Yeah, hi, Governor. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
So I feel, and I know a lot of people feel the same way, that the use of super PACs to run these negative ads in our elections here in Mass is actually damaging to not just candidates and campaigns, but voters as well. And I remember in your first campaign, there were some pretty nasty ads run against you. And,
yeah, I remember too.
Yeah. And, you know, I guess I'm worried that we're going to be seeing a lot of that in this race to replace you now. So my question is, what do you think that we can do, if anything, to avoid the use of these kinds of ads?
Well, Colin, I'm a strong believer that negative ads are counterproductive. I know there's a view out there that they work. I actually don't think they work to do anything except further alienate people from participating in the political process. And we need people to participate because we get the government we deserve. And if you want better government, you got to get involved and vote and ideally work for the candidates you think will bring that better government. And I think that a candidate who talks about what he or she is for rather than what he or she is against is a more compelling candidate. So I'm hoping, notwithstanding Citizens United and the Supreme Court's all call to as much money as possible in politics, that notwithstanding that, all of the candidates will show some restraint and will reject negative ads from their own campaigns or by other campaigns against them.
That is the voice of Governor Deval Patrick. Colin, thank you so much for the call. Our number is 877-301-8970. Governor, we rarely give you an opportunity to crow about good things. So we're going to be...
Well, we're just talking about the N.E. Casey.
Well, that's true. We're going to give you a second opportunity because by my recollection, the unemployment rate in the state is the lowest it's been. What is it, in 6 years? Six, something like that.
I think you're right.
Give us an update on that, if
we
you would.
We are at 5.5%, which is terrific. Obviously not low enough, but we have the highest level of employment in 25 years in the Commonwealth right now. We've regained all the jobs we lost in the recession in number, that is, and added net on top of that. So I had a goal when I first came in of 100,000 new jobs and net new jobs. And we are at 119,000, I want to say, thereabouts, notwithstanding the worst economic collapse in living memory. So that feels really good. And we're moving in a good direction. And obviously, we want to continue to make sure that prosperity is experienced across the board, that we push it out beyond Cambridge, Boston, Metro West, and so on, and reach all of the gateway cities as well. There's a lot more work to do, but it's really, really positive, and it continues a very positive trend.
This is a question, Governor, from Kirk Carapesa. He's our higher education reporter. He says that Massachusetts community colleges are entering their second year receiving performance-based funding, mm-hmm. as funding based on graduation rates and job placement. You're a big fan of this plan. So he wants to know, how's it working, and how will the state know whether it's been effective?
Yeah, it's working pretty well. Some of them were doing it before the reform went into place, and those that weren't are now doing it, and those that opposed or resisted the change have found a lot of reason to be enthusiastic about it, which is terrific. The grants are competitive. In an ideal world, all of the funding would be performance-based. We have a compromise, as you can expect here, where there's some funding which is legacy funding, basically is based on last year's budget. And then there's a portion that is competitive based on what you're producing in terms of helping people get into the workforce. I'm very sensitive and have come to be, thanks to the community colleges, that they have a dual mission, right? They're not glorified job training centers. They are also about helping people who weren't ready for four-year colleges to be ready for four-year colleges, and I get that. But they can be much better leveraged to help people get ready for the jobs we have already, right? Because we have this skills gap right now. And the best of them have been doing a wonderful job in that.
Governor, back to the calls, if you would.
Okay. Christopher is calling from Boston.
Christopher. Hi, Christopher.
Hi. My question is, what What has the state considered about the impact of the expansion of the Panama Canal?
Oh, wow.
The fact that it's going to introduce larger ships,
yeah,
which are going to choose ports, and Boston may not be one of them.
That's a really interesting question. So we were in Panama in December, I think it was, and on a sweep through, February, someone's whispering to me across the studio, in February.
Close enough.
On a swing through Panama and Mexico, and we went out to visit the Panama Canal and the construction, and we're toured around by the leadership of the canal, and we had the head of Massport with us. And we got some really helpful insights between that and a visit to the port in Cartagena in Colombia a little while ago, which is one of the most effective and successful ports in the world. You are right that because the ships will be built for the larger canal, much of the United States is not ready to accommodate a ship that size. Cartagena's strategy, Christopher, as you may know, is to be the offloading point where they put cargo from those bigger ships on smaller ships to deploy elsewhere. Here, we're going to dredge our harbor so that we can accommodate those ships, and we have an act of the Congress signed into law by the president that's going to help us do just that.
Christopher, thank you for the call. Governor, I know you really like it when I ask you the exact same question every month, so let me do that if I may, because I know it lifts your spirits. This is a variation on, is there any buyer's remorse about championing the casino bill? Since we saw you last, Delaware legislature passes a $10 million bailout to keep their casinos afloat. Atlantic City, I'm sure you read the story in the New York Times, 4 of the 12 casinos will shut their doors by the end of the year unless something dramatic happens, including Trump. The longer it goes, forget buyer's remorse, the words of a Dorchester guy, Shelley Adelson, who decided not to get from the Sands, who decided not to get involved here because he said there was oversaturation, potentially three casinos,
right,
and a slots parlor. Do you not say to yourself that one of the leaders, the Charlie Baker idea, let's do one.
Yeah.
It's been awarded to Springfield so far, and let's see how it goes before the additional ones are awarded by the Gaming Commission, and the slots parlor has been awarded too. Does that not seem to make most sense in this economic/casino environment?
Well, the Gaming Commission has all the authority it needs to do just that. There's nothing in the law that says they have to award all the licenses now. There are enough questions about the ones in Region A or Region 1, region where in my own view, the commission would be within its rights to reject both of them. We have the tribal facility down in the South Coast region, which is still on deck and awaiting the final federal approval. But I guess I would say this. Look, there are those who point to the downturn in Atlantic City as a reason not to expand gaming at all. Nobody points to, a shopping mall failure in Ohio to say we shouldn't have any more shopping malls. It's a market, right? It's going to go up. It's going to go down. The notion of having no more than three destination resorts is embedded in the law. But there's, the idea of not awarding all those licenses right now is entirely up to the commission.
But do you not worry that if they do award three and the slots parlor has been awarded, that may lead to the kind of oversaturation and potential failure of one or more that obviously is not in our interest?
That's a risk with any new venture. But they have expertise in the commission to evaluate precisely that kind of thing. And presumably they will use it. But remember, these are cycles. So, I don't have any problem with the idea of trying one or two and waiting to see. And and the commission has the authority to do just that.
You know, here's an email from Scott in New Bedford. Jim and I were talking about this the other day, that almost every presidential cycle there is a politician from Massachusetts in the mix. You know, last time, of course, it was Mitt Romney. Now people are talking about Mitt Romney maybe running again, Elizabeth Warren running again, although both of them insist that they're not running at all. So Scott wants to know, does the governor believe the nation as a whole will ever elect a president or vice president from liberal Massachusetts? And do you hold your opinion strongly or not so strongly? We don't seem to win. We haven't won since JFK, but we're there all the time.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, we have won. So I, from liberal Massachusetts is not that liberal. I mean, you know, we talk about being reliably blue. We are, we have more unenrolled independents than we do registered Democrats and registered Republicans combined.
Yeah.
We're a very discerning place when it comes to electing our elected officials, and we have Democrats in Massachusetts who'd be Republicans anywhere else. I mean, it's just we have the whole spectrum, is what I'm saying. I think the nation is also probably more discerning than the message, your email message or the question suggests. You know, the nation wants, and the people are smart about good leadership. And whether that comes from Massachusetts or some other place in the next cycle, we'll see.
Are you closer to selecting a candidate? I mean, you were widely quoted from a national television show about your concerns about the, quote, invincibility factor around Hillary Clinton. I don't know how this works. Does Hillary Clinton call you, or do her people call you? Or you've been solicited on her behalf?
No, we had a chance to visit a little bit out at Bio in San Diego mm-hmm. when I was out there. She was the keynote speaker, and I had a chance to visit with her. It's not like we're pals. I don't know her very, very well. I respect her enormously. My comment, the one that was widely quoted, which apparently, Jim, you did not read.
Shame
was
on you, Jim.
Marjorie recounted it to me.
Was not that she was invincible. That's not my point. My point is that there is an air of inevitability around her candidacy.
Yeah.
And the worry about that is that that can be interpreted by people as entitlement. And that's off-putting to folks. I mean, I think voters want you to sweat for it. You know, they want you to be hungry for it. They want you to persuade them why you're the right person. And I worry about the campaign kind of, you know, I don't think it's so much her, but the campaign and the kind of whole sort of movement is now's the time.
Sort of like last time she ran against your
friend. I think it was a factor then.
Our number is 877-301-8970. Back to the calls, Governor Patrick.
I'm sorry, Marjorie.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's okay. He just brushes me right off. Go ahead, Governor. Forget it.
No, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Paul is calling from Chelsea. Paul, you there?
Yes, I am, Governor. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I want to thank you for inviting the refugees in. Chelsea has always welcomed refugees of every stripe. There are now a lot of Central American immigrants here. Some of them are probably illegal, but they're well-behaved. Their children are well-behaved. They add to the economy. So thank you very much. That's all. I didn't have a question. I just wanted to thank you for it.
Well, thank you. Thank you,
Paul,
very much.
Paul, thanks for the call.
We're getting
we
a lot of emails, by the way, thanking the governor as well. We'll send them on to you.
Thanks.
Happy
Next
news.
One.
Should I go on?
Sure.
Richard is calling from... Richard, didn't you just call?
Richard, are you back?
Are you back?
There?
So I'm back.
No, wait a second. Are you really back?
Yes, this is truly me.
Well, did you call it in the same show?
No, I tried to call in and
okay.
I cut off.
Okay, I'm sorry. Okay, go ahead.
I think I was the next person up.
Our apologies.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Richard. Sorry.
Sorry about that. I don't have any control over the buttons. I just want you to know.
I know. Well, you know, sometimes they're a mystery to me, too. I'm calling from Groton, Massachusetts.
Yes, sir.
We're one of the 45 towns being impacted by this massive pipeline project, which, you know, is really the biggest infrastructure project in the state since at least the Big Dig, maybe even depending on how you measure it. Before that, there's been virtually no discussion about this. I'm very concerned now that the company, Kinder Morgan, behind it, has decided to bypass the state altogether and go directly to FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, to get the power of eminent domain to be able to do this. And I'm wondering what your reaction is to their decision to bypass the state in general and your thoughts on this massive project that's going through all kinds of conservation lands, including state park land, Audubon Society land. I mean, it's really, it's just kind of shocking that nobody's talking about it.
Well, Richard, as I said, in response to an earlier call, I am skeptical about this particular proposal, but I shouldn't have even called it a proposal. There is no proposal. There's an idea. They haven't gone anywhere with it. They haven't filed anything. They haven't started the public process. There will be a public process. There is no bypassing the state in the sense that the state has decision-making authority. FERC has the decision-making authority. It's not a choice about whether they go to FERC or someplace else at the federal level. There will be local input, and I mean not just from affected landowners and other interested parties, but even permission to do surveys of the proposed route. And I keep hearing about a number of towns refusing to give access in order to do those surveys. So it's, to me, it seems more less and less likely that this particular idea is going to turn into a real project. And I think it has a whole lot to do with how well organized people have become at the grassroots level. But the reason I think there hasn't been more attention to it is because there is no there yet. It's an idea on a piece of paper, not a proposal that has started the whole that will start the whole public engagement process.
Richard, thank you so much for the call. Governor, back to the calls.
Let's see. Karen? Is it Karen calling?
Looks like
Foxborough?
Karen. Yep.
I got to get my glasses.
Hi, Karen. You're on with the governor.
Karen, you there?
Hello. Hi.
Yes.
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well. How are you?
Very well, thanks. Governor, frankly, I'm a little upset at your characterization that the housing of the illegal immigrant children would be at the sole and exclusive cost of the federal government. First question is, isn't that just all of us paying? And second question is what guarantee do we have that these children are going back and going to be returned to their parents, who are, the, in my view, the sole cause of all of this and should be the responsible parties? And what about deterrence? There is a flood, an absolute flood of these children crossing our border. This is a policy failure of Obama. And we are being asked to pay, yet once again, to pay for these, you know, massive policy failure. It's very upsetting. It's not about color of skin, and it's not about insensitivity. And frankly, I'm upset at the comparison to the Holocaust. I think that's wholly inappropriate.
Well, Karen, first of all, on the you're right. It is our money, whether it's state or federal tax dollars, and our money is going to be spent to shelter in a safe environment these kids, whether it's down at the southern border or here. Or in some other state, including the six or seven states that are offering temporary shelter right now. So the question is, are we in Massachusetts able to relieve some of that pressure at the southern border while we're processing through our laws? And on that point, we have a series of laws on processing these children, and the choices, as I understand it, are to send them back, to reunite them with family and then send them back, or to give them asylum. And that is made, those decisions are made under law, person by person. And it takes some time to do that. We have not in this country, historically, simply rounded people up and shipped them and shipped them out. In terms of the reasons that they are coming, as it's explained to me and has been explained publicly, they are being sent by their families over 1,000 miles to escape extreme violence in their communities. Now, whether you think that's a good reason or not for a parent to do such a thing, that's a reality in the world in those places, and it's having some impact here. I don't think most Americans think sending a child back who is unsupervised into a ineffective war zone is consistent with American values. I don't get the rhetoric around this being a failure of the president's immigration policy, since the policy says that when a child unaccompanied comes across the border and throws themselves in the arms of a Border Patrol agent for future processing was signed into law by George W. Bush. But that is the law right now. And in the absence of a change in the law, they're going to be processed accordingly, and they should. That's also a tradition of ours.
And by the way, we should just add, Karen, thanks for the call. We should add the president himself is actually proposing to amend the law signed by Bush in 2008 that would streamline the process a little bit. So
that one last thing she mentioned, though, the comparison to the Holocaust and the children coming over here and being sent back. Have you gotten much blowback on that?
No, because most people don't hear me to be saying that the violence in Central America is the same as the Holocaust. I never said that. What I said was, and what I believe, is that we don't take desperate people who come to our shores seeking refuge and send them back into desperate situations. We have been sanctuary for Irish children fleeing famine, Haitian children fleeing the earthquake, Russian and Ukrainian children fleeing religious persecution. You can go on and on and on. Children from Sudan fleeing civil war. And the one time in our lives, in the life of this country, when we turned children back was that example of the St. Louis in 1939. I think it enhanced our stature in the world and does even today when we shelter these children, and it is a blight on our reputation in the world when we don't.
Governor, thank you. Governor, we should say, as we say at the end of this all the time, the lines are full. If you stay on hold, one of our producers will take your phone number. The governor's office will call you. We have a ton of email today.
We do have a ton of email, which we couldn't get to.
We got to some today.
Some, but not nearly enough.
You'll send it on, though.
All four Facebook postings, anything we got for the governor will go to his office, and they will respond. Governor, it's good to see you.
Great
see you next
see
month.
You.
Take
Thank
care.
You.
Yeah, Governor Deval Patrick, as Jim just said, joins us every month for Ask the Governor. Thank you again, Governor Patrick, for your time. Up next, Boston Globe columnist Alex Beam joins us for Open Mic. That conversation next on 89.7 WGBH.
If there's a vehicle at home you no longer need, why not turn it into something everyone counts on?